So we're going to talk about right intention today, tonight. And I thought I'd start with a poem. It's not really a poem. It's a reflection of Dhamma by a guy named Ian McCrory, which I've been reading his book, The Moon Appears When the Water is Still, quite a bit. I love it. Somebody gave it to me and I started reading it and I thought, oh my God, this is great wisdom. So I think this reflection he gives on the nature of Dhamma and what I points to what I want to talk about. So he says, the Dhamma teaches you to be selfish, think only of your own happiness, and strive ceaselessly to increase it. The Dhamma teaches you to be selfish, think only of your own happiness, and strive ceaselessly to increase it. But as you grow in wisdom, it becomes clearer and clearer that your happiness is inextricably linked to others. Your happiness cannot increase at the expense of others, nor can you remain unhappy as all those around you are in joy. Though you be naked, homeless, and hungry, if the happiness of others is paramount, you will be clothed, sheltered, and fed with a joy beyond compare. But without wisdom to guide you, though you attain everything in the world, your only true possession will be misery. So be selfish and do all you can to increase the happiness of others. This is really what I want to talk about, this idea that kind of permeates through Dhamma Buddhist communities, that oftentimes our practice as practitioners is a kind of selfish kind of way of being. So it's self-indulgent. So the going on retreats, the sitting still, the doing our meditation practice carries with it this idea that we're very self-centered and that the whole world around us is actually struggling and having more difficulty. So actually, it's not really like that. For practitioners, there is in our society a constant focus towards external relationships. There's a constant kind of push towards how are you taking care of others? And we as practitioners can get caught in this constantly trying to take care of others and constantly trying to be for others at the expense of ourselves. And by ignoring our own internal process and instead always looking externally, we actually find that we become more and more and more spent, more and more and more weary, less and less and less capable because of this constant focus towards the external. But in truth, the Dhamma, as its practice, brings us more and more and more and more within into this internal understanding. And the more we become connected to our internal understanding, the more we begin to see how to actually steady ourselves. The more we begin to just have the capacity to be with whatever is arising. So the more we actually see and practice and cultivate this internal, something begins to happen. Our ability to actually support the external and to be of help and of goodwill and increase the happiness of people around us begins to happen. Not because we have put all our focus externally, but because we have strengthened the internal to something that is much more powerful. And I think the way to begin to focus this is through right intention. And I like the word right rather than using the word wise, because right intention, as I'm going to show you, is connected to the Eightfold Path. And there's a way in which modern English, we say wise. We call the Eightfold Path wise factors. And I do think that they're wise, but I really like to say right. And the reason why I like to say right is because it reminds me that if I'm trying to go northbound, going out of the parking lot and heading southbound, I may eventually get northbound, but the right path is to turn right and head north. So there's a way in which saying the word right to me isn't equated with right or wrong. It is the right way in order to get to this awakening. So that's what this right stands for. It's the right way towards awakening. It is the most direct path towards awakening. And that's what I look at the word right. So right intention is connected to the Eightfold Path. Just a little bit of a kind of a setting it up, the framing of it. Right intention is connected to the Eightfold Path. It's part of the wisdom training in the Eightfold Path. So the Eightfold Path has three trainings, one in wisdom, middle one is in ethical conduct, and the third one is in samadhi. So this wisdom path is connected to right view, right intention. We're not really going to talk a lot about right view, but just to put the framing, I'll give a little understanding just so we have the framing here. So right view, right intention is the wisdom path. Right conduct, right speech, right livelihood, that's your ethical training. And then samadhi is right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So when you take all of this together, you cultivate the fundamental movement towards awakening. The thing about an awakened being is an awakened being cannot, will not harm another being. It's not possible, because an awakened being is a being that is steeped in non-harm. It's the human beings have a way of harming each other just naturally, but an awakened being is a being that no longer causes any harm to any other being. In fact, an awakened being would not harm any sentient being. In the precepts, the first precept in right conduct says that you undertake the training to not kill another being. And for a long time, I thought that meant you're not gonna shoot somebody, stab somebody, kill somebody. But my teacher, Venerable Pano Wadi, I don't know if you guys have ever listened to her, but Venerable Pano Wadi one time told me that what the Pali says is that you undertake the training to not take the breath away of another being. So the breath away would be their lifeness, their that which makes them alive. So you wouldn't take away their, you wouldn't judge them or limit them in any way as well. It's not just whether or not you would kill them, stab them, because none of us would actually do that. But we could very well take the breath away of someone by simply judging them as bad people or judging them as, you know, not important, insignificant, and take their life breath away. And so this idea of not judging, of non-harming is fundamentally a willingness to not diminish, not judge, not take away the breath of another being. And so in this whole capacity for being awakened being, you are not going to cause any harm to another being. And so that's really what we're moving towards. We are gradually moving along a path where any being in the world would feel safe with us. Just by being in our presence, there would be a sense of safety around it. It doesn't mean we're going to glow and float on air, but it means that we hold all life sacred and no being is going to be harmed by us. So if you just take a moment and you think about that, even me, I'm kind of a long ways from that kind of way of being. And so there's always this work on the path for learning how, figuring out how to be in the world and not cause any harm, which is not an easy thing to do. Right intention is the focus of that. It's the turning towards awakening. Right view in this wisdom. I do think it's significant that the Buddha did not put mindfulness, he did not put samadhi at the top of the list of his factors. He put samadhi at the very bottom of the path. It is the least of all of the path factors that's at the bottom. And yet we sometimes treat samadhi like it's up here, like, ooh, samadhi, and everything else is kind of secondary. We spend all our time striving to get peaceful and concentrated rather than paying attention to something like right intention, right view. But the Buddha put right view, right intention at the very top of the path factors. And he put it at the top, I think, because when you adjust your view like a compass, you adjust your view towards understanding the nature of dukkha, understanding the nature of the phenomena, the existing world we live in, understanding the three characteristics, understanding this nature of what we're dealing with here. Then you put your compass towards north, which is right intention, and you're on your way. You may have to stop at lights, or you may have to get some gas. You may have to do all kinds of things, but you are headed in the right direction. And you are going to eventually, if you live in Seattle, you are eventually going to get to that border in Canada and have to stop a moment and try to get past the border. So eventually you're going to get there. It may take you longer than it takes me. It may take me longer than it takes you. But as long as we're going north, we are going to eventually hit Canada. It's just, there's no doubt about it. There's no extra weight put upon us. The direction is what leads to us getting to Canada. Whether we know where Canada is or not, we may not even have any GPS. We may not know, but we have a compass that points towards north, and we are in a car that's taking us north, we are going to get there. That's what We don't even have to be in a car. We can walk and still get there. The point is, we have a compass that's pointing towards north, and Canada is north. So however we move and whatever happens along the way, we are still going to eventually get to that Canadian border. This is what I think. This is why I think right intention and beginning to cultivate this is so important for lay practitioners. Because oftentimes, when we think about practice, I have so many students that tell me all the time, yeah, I'm sorry, I haven't been practicing. I'm like, you haven't? I think of you as a practitioner. Yeah, but I want to practice, but I haven't been practicing. I haven't had the time. And I'm thinking to myself, how can you not have the time to set your compass towards north? I mean, that you've already set the compass towards north. You're eventually going to get to Canada. But I came to understand that what people call practice is meditation. So what they think is, if I didn't meditate, I'm not practicing. If I didn't, or if they meditate and the mind is all busy, talky, I did not have good practice. It was not good practice. It's that's samadhi down at the bottom of the rung. But in reality, practice starts in this path factor, right view, right intention. So if you have this right intention to awaken, then every blessed thing that you do is practice. Everything you do. There's nothing that you're not doing that isn't practice, because everything about your life is pointed towards right intention. Everything is pointed towards north. Everything is pointed towards your compass. And you will eventually get to samadhi and all the rest of it. But if you limit practice to only being the cultivation of samadhi on the cushion, then you're right. You're going to have this felt sense of stopping and starting and coming and going. And in an urban life, sometimes we can do that. We're like steady in our meditation every day. Good. And then boom, something happens. Work changes. It gets harder. I got to work longer. I can't get up in the morning. All kinds of things. Just something as simple as daylight savings time can change our whole disposition and we're too sleepy. Or something happens. One of your family members, something happens to them and you're worried and anxious, and all kinds of life situations show up, and it will affect your capacity to sit still, samadhi, concentration. But it will never affect your right intention. That right intention, whether you're on the highway speeding down the road at 70 or 65 or 80, depending on whether you're more in my lane or you're more in your lane. Doesn't matter whether you're on the freeway flying down the highway or whether you're in the back roads traveling around, winding roads with only one lane, and you're behind a trailer, some kind of tractor from the farm going like 10 miles an hour. It doesn't matter. You're still headed north. And so what I think it's brilliant that the Buddha put the path factor of right intention way up at the top of our practice. And so cultivating right intention is far more important than how much time you spend on the cushion, especially for urban practitioners. We need to cultivate right intention in everything we're doing. And as we cultivate right intention, it will affect our conduct and it will affect our ability to steady the mind. This is why when you go on retreat, you start that retreat with the precepts, saying the precepts. You start the retreat in this noble silence. We do this opening ceremony, and that opening ceremony with the precepts, setting the tone for the unfolding of the retreat, what we are actually doing is setting this intention to focus our attention, to practice and not harm anyone. We're setting the intention for the retreat to unfold in this way. But at the time we take the precepts, we haven't hurt nobody yet. We haven't done anything yet. We're just sitting on the chair or the cushion and we say the precepts. But where the actual retreat unfolds and whether our conduct is keeping with the actual precepts, that hasn't happened yet. And the samadhi that ultimately comes, that hasn't happened yet. We set an intention at the beginning of the retreat, and that intention is what we strive to live within throughout that entire retreat. And as we live within that capacity, then what unfolds is our conduct gets very kind. We're kind to ants. We won't step on an ant. If we see the ant walking across the little pathway in front of us, we will go around. When we're at home, we don't think about ants. We'll step anywhere. But when we're on retreat, we are looking down, looking for ants, and we will not step on them. We will go out of our way in order for the little living beings on the land to be cared for. We'll take care of trees. We'll take care of plants. We'll take care of everybody. And the longer your retreat, the softer your heart gets and the softer your conduct gets and the more settled you get into kindness. Without you doing anything, it just happens because you set this intention at the beginning of the retreat to follow the precepts. And you kind of reinforce that over and over and over. And the more settled and kinder and softer you get, the Buddha said, and he was right, you don't have to have a force of will. You don't have to say, may I please get tranquility. Tranquility comes automatically for people who have joy. And you don't have to say, may I please have joy. Joy comes automatically for people who have, you know, cultivated mindfulness. And it just sort of this back, what he was saying was, once you align your intention within the context of the precepts, then from then on, you are headed in the right direction. You are headed in the right direction, and everything you do will be balanced against this. And you will gradually move towards samadhi automatically. So this path factors automatically flow through the Eightfold Path. So a little bit more here. The right intention is a little bit more detailed here than just right intention. It's not just saying the intention. Buddha actually divided it up. It's actually thought of as both kamma, which is action, and thought, so thinking, and it is an impulse. So you can think of intention as both the impulse or energetic motivation behind conduct. You could think of it as the conduct itself, because whatever that intention is, that conduct is going to be the result. So in other words, if you're going to Canada and you're moving north, you're going north once you set the intention to go north. Once you set the intention at the beginning of a retreat, your conduct will flow towards that intention. And the more sincere you are about your intention to follow the precepts, the more likely you will to follow the precepts. That result will come. It's At the same time, it is so the right intention, intention itself is gonna point to our energetic energy. It's gonna point to our physical conduct, and it's gonna point to what we're thinking about. So a lot of our intention can be seen in our expectations, our assumptions, our desires, beliefs, opinions, all of that kind of control a lot of our attention and our intentions. But the two things I wanted to talk about right intention and why it's important to cultivate it comes from two things that the Buddha did. One comes from a conversation he had with his son, Rahula, when his son was 7 years old. So I don't know how many of you know this sutta, but the first time I ever heard about it, I was shocked that he would talk to his son like this. So Rahula was a monk, a novice monk, very young. And Buddha was giving him instructions on how to practice. And he said, and basically his instructions are on his intentions. So he tells Rahula, before you do anything, first he asks Rahula, what do you think a mirror is? And Rahula said, well, it shows your reflections. And he goes, that's right. So you want to reflect constantly like a mirror on your actions. And so he said, whatever you do, whether it's mental, you think it, physical, you do it, or verbal, you say it. Whatever you do in any of those contexts, you have to reflect. Is this thing, this thought, this action, this this thing I'm about to say, is it harmful? Will it harm another being? And if you come to the conclusion, no, you can do it. But then he says, but you have to reflect. Is it skillful? Will it lead to a positive consequence? Is it unskillful? Will it lead to some painful, harmful consequence? If your answer is that it's skillful, you can do it. If it's no, it's not going to be skillful, don't do it. And then he says, you have to think about that, reflect on that during the entire time you're doing the thing, saying it, thinking it. And then after you have finished doing, saying, thinking something, you have to reflect. Was that harmful for me? Was it harmful for another? Was it harmful for both of us? Was it skillful? Was it unskillful? Every time. Now, I don't know if you guys have kids, but first of all, I have had kids and I have a granddaughter that's 6 years old. You cannot tell a seven-year-old anything once and they can remember. And you certainly can't give them instructions as complicated as that. Even I know you got to keep it simple, tight. Just say, put the plate in the sink. That's good enough. Let's say that. Put the plate in the sink after you eat. Put the plate in the sink after you eat. You have to say that 9,000 times before they will actually get up from the table, put the plate in the sink when they're finished eating. Takes that much effort. And Buddha is telling Rahula that he has to reflect continuously on his conduct, on whether it was harmful or not harmful, or skillful or not skillful, before he does it, whether he thinks it, whether he does it physically, whether he says it, he has to do it during, he has to do it after. That is a lot of work to have to do that. But what I just, for a long time, thought that Buddha's instructions were just too complicated for a child to understand. what I realized in retrospect, now that I've been practicing for some time now, that Buddha was actually brilliant, what he told Rahula. And so I'm telling you, so that you can see how intention actually operates, right intention operates in our lives truly. So if before you ever thought anything, did anything, or said anything, you thought about whether or not it was skillful or not, that would be great. But let me say it like this. Three words you have to remember. First word, reflect. So what the Buddha was saying to Rahula is reflect. He did not tell Rahula how he had to be in any circumstance. He didn't say you have to be non-harming in all situations before you act or think or, you know, say anything. He didn't say that. He told him to reflect upon his conduct. That's it. Reflect upon what he was going to do. Reflect upon what he was going to say. Reflect upon it. So he said to reflect upon it continuously. So this idea of telling someone that they can reflect upon their behavior, whatever it is, without telling them what behavior to do, means that there's no perfection here. There's no right way to do it, wrong way to do it. There is only the reflection over, do you think this is skillful, this is unskillful, this is harmful? So the second thing that he said to Rahula that I thought was significant is this idea of repeatedly. So one, you reflect, and then you do so repeatedly. This idea of repeatedly reflecting means that there's no getting it perfect the first time. So it's a training. So you're undertaking the training, which means that Buddha must have assumed that Rahula would repeatedly do things unskillful, do things that were harmful, and that he would repeatedly have to reflect upon it over and over and over. And something about the repeated reflection upon his conduct would cause him to be able to discern what was the best way to be in any given situation. And then the last framing is after. This is a game changer to me. So how often do we think we got to be right, good, perfect, non-harming, skillful every time? We got to do it right there. We got to catch ourselves. And how many times do we get so upset with ourselves after we've done something unskillful, harmful, wished we hadn't done it, get caught in all that energy, and we do all this self-flagellation because we wished we hadn't did it? But the Buddha never made a distinction between doing something before or doing something after. It's all the same. So whether you reflect and you remember to reflect before you do something and consider, is this skillful? Rahula might jump right in. And then, okay, reflect while you're doing it. He may not even notice it. He just jumps right in and he's doing whatever he's doing. And then afterwards, he's done something. And then it's like, oh, maybe I shouldn't have done that. That reflection right there is of equal value to remembering before. So this idea that you can reflect on your words, on your physical conduct, on your thoughts, after it's done, and it is as valuable as if you had done it before, that this changes something about the way Dhamma is. And oftentimes, you don't know that you did something painful until after it was done. And then you realize that there was some harm there. And we tend to turn around and look at ourselves and beat ourselves up as if we should have known. But you didn't know it was harmful when you were doing it. It wasn't until afterwards that you learned it was harmful. If, as the Buddha instructed Rahula, you hold this framing that it is as valuable to discern wisdom after as it is to know before, then whatever you find out about your conduct, thoughts, speech afterwards, you could say, oh, I see, this is harmful, this is not. And greater, more often, as time goes on, you will begin to remember what to do before you do it. But only if you take the after and hold it in the same level of respect that you hold before. And when you hold it like that, now the fact that you have to repeatedly remember someone's pronoun because you are repeatedly forgetting someone's pronoun, and you know that that is harmful to mispronounce someone, but yet you keep doing it. If you hold it all together in one respect, then having to apologize and correct the pronoun, you just keep doing it. And eventually the mind lines up and you begin to remember and catch it ahead of time. You begin to think things ahead of time. This is the nature of right intention. If you're pointed in the right direction, then you will come to understand exactly how to align your conduct in such a way that you will not cause any harm. But it comes from not me telling you this is the way you should be. Because I could tell you, be like this, do that. In fact, many people tell us that all the time. But mostly, we don't do anything anybody else tells us to do. If we agree with it, then we will consider doing it. But mostly, we don't agree with it. We will not listen to other people. We can hear it. It sounds wise. We will never do it until we come to an understanding in ourselves that says, I want to do that. Then we will begin to set our intentions towards making it happen. So what the Buddha was teaching Rahula at 7 years old is to learn to trust your own discernment, to learn to feel into and understand harm and non-harm, what's skillful and not skillful based on your own movement through the world. And however you move through the world, whatever comes up, whatever happens in whatever you do, whatever you say, whatever you think, there's no judgment on it one way or the other. He kind of wiped out the idea of shaming people because Rahula could at any point reflect upon his conduct. And if he noticed that something wasn't skillful or was harmful, he could say, oh, we'll have to remember that next time. That's skillful. That's not skillful. That's harmful. That's not harmful. And he would know for himself how to move through the world. You can see that that kind of understanding strengthens our own ability to move through the world. It's an internal reflection. It's not an external reflection. It is a deeper and deeper and deeper trusting internally who we are and where we are. The second kind of thing that the Buddha pointed to, this is the last piece I want to talk about, is his thoughts, you know, his own thoughts. I'm sure that the Buddha had plenty of reason to regret what happened to him and what, you know, I mean, his mom died. So we all know people who lost a parent when they were young. And there's a lot of pain that gets attached to that. Buddha was a regular human being like us. So I'm sure he had, you know, regrets about that when he decided to take on this practice of meditation and stillness and samadhi. He was pretty much shunned by all his friends. They all left him. So I'm sure he had some resentment and some regrets about that. And I just think there was just energy that showed up in his mind. And I think that because at one point he talked about having thoughts around ill will and harm and self-indulgence. So we all know when we're sitting in meditation that we can get lost in fantasies and wishing, you know, thinking about all the stuff we like. We know we can get lost in that kind of thinking. We know that we get lost in, you know, irritation and pain and aversion and grumbling about people, remembering things that people said and did. And we can get lost in that aversive kind of ill will, this desirous self-indulgence, or just basically being cruel to ourselves in the judgments and cruel in the moment, you know, that is a very natural part of the human mind. It just arises as part of our practice. At the same time, he also noticed that he had thoughts that were not of that nature, thoughts that were kind, thoughts that were, you know, non-harming, very supportive, and thoughts that were restrained. His, you know, like coming back to the breath over and over and over. It's a restraining kind of a thought, but it is a thought to say, come back. It is a thought to keep coming back to your anchor. It is a thought to keep setting your intention towards staying in the present moment, regardless of what's happening. So those are two ways of thinking. And he understood that he had these two ways of thinking. He did not get caught, thrown off by either way. What he did was, he said, I divided my thoughts up. These were the thoughts that were unwholesome. It was ill will, aversion, you know, self-indulgent kind of harmful thoughts. And then there were these thoughts that were non-harming, kind, and full of restraint. He divided his thoughts up into those, and then he cultivated as often as he could the wholesome thoughts. What that tells you is the Buddha was thinking. In case you didn't realize that, thinking is inherently part of meditating. So this idea that I'm going to wipe away the thinking, that is not realistic. So the Buddha himself was thinking, and because he was thinking, he was not caught up in judging his thoughts, nor was he caught up in beating himself up or getting lost in the thoughts. He wasn't beating himself up about thinking, and he wasn't getting lost in the thoughts. What he was doing was he was recognizing he was thinking, and he was watching what happens when I think like this, and watching what happens when I think like this, and then setting this intention to have his thoughts cultivated towards these what are called right intentions, non-harm, goodwill or kindness, and renunciation. I call that restraint. So this idea that he would align his thoughts on this more wholesome side is the what helped him set his intention towards awakening. And the thoughts that were just wasting his time, going to add more dukkha, then that he did not get caught in. So what this would look like is you're sitting there in meditation, you're trying to meditate, you just found out some stupid thing at work, you're all upset about it, in a tizzy, mind keeps thinking about it, and you can't get the mind to stop. You could indulge yourself by just dwelling on that, or whenever you become awake, you could consider, is this thinking process skillful? Is it harmful? Is it going to lead to painful consequences? And if it is, then don't indulge it. then you're, the actual practice is less about don't think about it and more about setting the restraint or the intention to be kind, to non-harm, and to have this restraint, even with yourself. And it doesn't matter what circumstance you're in. It doesn't matter if you're sitting in your meditation and you apply this right intention. If you're on your way to the grocery store, you apply this meditation or this intention, or whether or not you're talking to your friend, you're at work, doesn't matter. Either way, the whole thing is about just applying that intention in and of itself. So what all of this points to, what I'm pointing to is to begin to cultivate right intention, which is framing everything you do in whether or not what is happening is harmful, whether you are being as kind as you can, and whether or not there's a degree of restraint here. Are you indulging in getting what you want or not getting what you don't want, trying to control the situation? Or are you having a degree of restraint? Are you being as kind as you can be in this moment? Or are you being not so kind? If you notice you're being not so kind, see if you can be softer, a little kinder. And whether or not you are, whatever you're doing, whether you intended to or not, is it harmful to you or to another person or to the both of you? And if you begin to frame everything you're doing around this, looking back on it or whatever, you begin to sense into a completely different understanding. So I thought I would end with a poem by William Stafford, who I love this poem because I think this is right intention. And the thread that he's talking about in the poem that many of you might know, but think of this thread as your intention, as right intention. So he says, there's a thread you follow, an intention that you follow. It goes among things that change, but it does not change. People wonder about what you are pursuing, and you have to explain about the thread. But it's hard for others to see. While you hold on to it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen. People get hurt or die, and you suffer and get old. Nothing you do can stop time's unfolding. You just don't ever let go of the thread. So let's sit a moment. Okay. All right. So I hope you all got a sense that this is your practice, all of it. This is what you're practicing, is to cultivate discernment and wisdom in any given circumstance to begin to cultivate for yourself what is harmful, what is skillful, what is unskillful, what is unharmful, and to begin to strengthen your sense of right intention. So you have a broad right intention, and gradually you will begin to turn it towards a much more narrowed kind of, you know exactly. It's how I think awakened beings ultimately come to an understanding. They will not do any harm because they know how to assess any situation in any given moment because they have repeatedly reflected upon their conduct, their thoughts, and their speech. So thank you so much for having me. I appreciate being here always. Thank you all for supporting Cambridge Insight. I love coming here. I miss being with you in person, but this is like a great substitute, because otherwise I wouldn't be able to see you at all. So thank you so much. I appreciate your invitations. All right, bye-bye.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.